Chapter 18. Frederick Barnett's Wonder Jacker is one of those autobiographical novels that were popular throughout the third and fourth decades of the 20th century. It was published in 1970, and one must understand Wonder Jacker rather in a spiritual and intellectual than in a literal sense. It is indeed an elusive title, carrying the world back to the Wilhelm Meister of Goethe, a century and a half earlier. Its author, Frederick Barnett, gives a minute and curious history of his life and ideas between his 19th and his 23rd birthdays. He was neither a very original nor a very brilliant man, but he had a trick of circumstantial writing, and though no authentic portrait was to survive for the information of posterity, he betrays by a score of casual phrases that he was short, sturdy, inclined to be plump, with a rather blobby face, and full, rather projecting blue eyes. He belonged until the financial debacle of 1956 to the class of fairly prosperous people. He was a student in London, he aeroplaned to Italy, and then had a pedestrian tour from Genoa to Rome, crossed in the air to Greece and Egypt, and came back over the Balkans and Germany. His family fortunes, which were largely invested in bank shares, coal mines, and house property, were destroyed. Reduced to penury, he sought to earn a living. He suffered great hardship, and was then caught up by the war, and had a year of soldiering, first as an officer in the English infantry, and then in the Army of Pacification. His book tells all these things so simply, and at the same time so explicitly, that it remains, as it were, an eye by which future generations may have at least one man's vision of the years of the great change. And he was, he tells us, a modern state man by instinct from the beginning. He breathed in these ideas in the classrooms and laboratories of the Carnegie Foundation School that rose, a long and delicately beautiful facade, along the south bank of the Thames opposite the ancient dignity of Somerset House. Such thought was interwoven with the very fabric of that pioneer school in the educational renaissance in England. After the customary exchange years in Heidelberg and Paris, he went into the Classical School of London University. The older so-called classical education of the British pedagogues, probably the most paralyzing, ineffective, and foolish routine that ever wasted human life, had already been swept out of this great institution in favor of modern methods. And he learned Greek and Latin as well as he had learned German, Spanish, and French, so that he wrote and spoke them freely, and used them with an unconscious ease in his study of the foundation civilizations of the European system to which they were the key. This change was still so recent that he mentions an encounter in Rome with an Oxford don who apostrophe spoke Latin with a Wiltshire accent and manifest discomfort, wrote Greek letters with his tongue out, and seemed to think a Greek sentence a charm when it was a quotation and an impropriety when it wasn't. Barnett saw the last days of the coal steam engines upon the English railways, and the gradual cleansing of the London atmosphere as the smoke-creating sea coal fires gave place to electric heating. The building of laboratories at Kensington was still in progress, and he took part in the students' riots that delayed the removal of the Albert Memorial. He carried a banner with "We Like Funny Statuary" on one side, and on the other "Seats and Canopies for Statues, Why Should Our Great Departed Stand in the Rain?" He learned the rather athletic aviation of those days at the university grounds at Sydenham, and he was fined for flying over the new prison for political libelers at Wormwood Scrubs, in a manner calculated to exhilarate the prisoners while at exercise. That was the time of the attempted suppression of any criticism of the public judicature, and the place was crowded with journalists who had ventured to call attention to the dementia of Chief Justice Abrahams. Barnett was not a very good aviator. He confesses he was always a little afraid of his machine. There was excellent reason for everyone to be afraid of those clumsy early types, and he never attempted steep descents or very high flying. He also, he records, owned one of those oil-driven motor bicycles whose clumsy complexity and extravagant filthiness still astonish the visitors to the Museum of Machinery at South Kensington. He mentions running over a dog, and complains of the ruinous price of spatchcocks in Surrey. Spatchcocks, apostrophe it seems, was a slang term for crushed hens. He passed the examinations necessary to reduce his military service to a minimum, and his want of any special scientific or technical qualification and a certain precocious corpulence that handicapped his aviation indicated the infantry of the line as his sphere of training. That was the most generalized form of soldiering. The development of the theory of war had been for some decades but little assisted by any practical experience. What fighting had occurred in recent years had been fighting in minor or uncivilized states, with peasant or barbaric soldiers, and with but a small equipment of modern contrivances, and the great powers of the world were content for the most part to maintain armies that sustained in their broader organization the traditions of the European wars of 30 and 40 years before. There was the infantry arm to which Barnett belonged, and which was supposed to fight on foot with a rifle, and be the main portion of the army. There were cavalry forces, horse soldiers, having a ratio to the infantry, that had been determined by the experiences of the Franco-German War in 1871. There was also artillery, and for some unexplained reason much of this was still drawn by horses, though there were also in all the European armies a small number of motor guns with wheels so constructed that they could go over broken ground. In addition, there were large developments of the engineering arm concerned with motor transport, motor bicycle scouting, aviation, and the like. No first-class intelligence had been sought to specialize in and work out the problem of warfare with the new appliances, and under modern conditions, but a succession of able jurists, Lord Halton, Chief Justice Briggs, and that very able King's Counsel, Philbrick, had reconstructed the army frequently and thoroughly, and placed it at last, with the adoption of national service, upon a footing that would have seemed very imposing to the public of 1900. At any moment the British Empire could now put a million and a quarter of arguable soldiers upon the board of Weltpolitik. The traditions of Japan and the Central European armies were more princely and less forensic. The Chinese still refused resolutely to become a military power, and maintained a small standing army upon the American model that was said, so far as it went, to be highly efficient, and Russia, secured by a stringent administration against internal criticism, had scarcely altered the design of a uniform, or the organization of a battery since the opening decades of the century. Barnett's opinion of his military training was manifestly a poor one. His modern state ideas disposed him to regard it as a bore, and his common sense condemned it as useless. Moreover, his habit of body made him peculiarly sensitive to the fatigues and hardships of service. For 3 days in succession we turned out before dawn, and, for no earthly reason, without breakfast, apostrophe he relates. I suppose that is to show us that, when the day comes the first thing will be, to get us thoroughly uncomfortable and rotten. We then proceeded to Kriegspiel, according to the mysterious ideas of those in authority over us. On the last day we spent 3 hours under a hot, if early sun getting over 8 miles of country to a point we could have reached in a motor omnibus in 9 minutes, and a half I did it the next day in that, and then we made a massed attack upon entrenchments that could have shot us all about 3 times over, if only the umpires had let them. Then came a little bayonet exercise, but I doubt if I am sufficiently a barbarian to stick this long knife into anything living. Anyhow, in this battle I shouldn't have had a chance. Assuming that by some miracle I hadn't been shot 3 times over, I was far too hot and blown when I got up to the entrenchments, even to lift my beastly rifle. It was those others would have begun the sticking. For a time we were watched by two hostile aeroplanes. Then our own came up, and asked them not to, and the practice of aerial warfare still being unknown, they very politely desisted and went away, and did dives, and circles of the most charming description over the Fox Hills. All Barnett's accounts of his military training were written in the same half-contemptuous, half-protesting tone. He was of opinion that his chances of participating in any real warfare were very slight, and that, if after all he should participate, it was bound to be so entirely different from these peace maneuvers, that his only course as a rational man would be to keep as observantly out of danger as he could until he had learned the tricks and possibilities of the new conditions. He states this quite frankly. Never was a man more free from sham heroics. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.